Saw Maddie now a few months ago now. I ran across a story one day in the news that I thought of in a Bible reading this week, and it's a little bit of the place where we find ourselves in kind of reflecting on life or thinking about life, where we get caught between the reality of the fleeting nature of things and the longing for the permanent, or the trying to recognize the permanent things that go on. It's kind of a we live our whole time sort of caught in the middle of the tug between those two aspects of life. And this is a story about a lady who lived somewhere in Florida, and this was one of the deals that got tossed around social media because so many people liked it. And it's a story about a lady who wrote her own obituary. And that sounds sort of sad, doesn't it, to start out with? But I want you to think about what happens here. The piece begins, "It pains me to admit it, but apparently I have passed away. Everyone told me it would happen one day, but that's simply not something I wanted to hear, much less experience." And she goes ahead through it, and she talks about, kind of the journey from elementary school to stuff her father did with her to what they did in 4-H and being in the high school band, and some of the parades they were in. And she talks about a lot of the funny things and sad things that happened to her. And she says, "So many things in my life seemed of little significance at the time they happened, but then they took on a greater importance as I got older. The memories I'm taking with me now are so precious and have more value than all the gold and silver in my jewelry box." She talks about some of the family experiences and all that kind of thing, and here's the part of it that kind of sticks with me. She says, "So, this is the end of it. So, I was born, I blinked, and it was all over." And you think about that, and she says, "No buildings named after me, no monuments erected in my honor." But she said, "I did have the chance to know and love each and every friend as well as all my family members." So I want you to think about that for a minute and to ask yourself in your mind, first, are you old enough to have thought that yet? And second, under what circumstances do those kinds of thoughts pass through your mind? What makes you reflect on the nature of our lives here and our journeys through this world, and to try to sort out in your mind the strands of the things that are just passing and temporary from the strands of the things that are going to be lasting and meaningful even when you get to the end of your journey? And can you and I do that without becoming so melancholy that it just seems like a sort of a sad or a dreary experience even to think about the nature of our lives here? And how many of you can remember, the sermons that you heard preachers preach? Not me, of course, but how many of you are like me? I remember first starting to go to church when I was an older teenager and hearing the preachers talk about, one of these days you're gonna come to the end of all of this, and none of us know if we'll be here next week, and all that kind of thing. So you need to be ready now. How many of you heard that over and over? And I soon thought, well, I heard that last week and the week before that, and I'm still here, so probably I'm going to be here, you know, that kind of thing. You've been through that. Well, apparently, that has always been a human habit and a human reality, because there are great passages in Scripture. Psalm 90 is the most famous. Psalm 39 is a whole lot like this. The 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes is like this. Jesus' story about the rich fool is like this. That remind us of sort of who we are as individuals versus the way the world is for humanity, for all of us. And this one this morning is one that I just think is maybe worthy of thought because it's most famous, and also, I'll be honest with you, because of the, I'm just thinking over the changes in our family life over the past year, or I mean, we're about a year right now from what happened to our brother Jackie. I've been thinking about Clay and Sharon, you know, and how I can't keep from it, and I don't mean it to be sad. I mean it to be, this is how things are, and we're thankful to be able to remember people who were faithful all the way through, and this is the value in what we who are Christians believe. And I think this psalm is worth thinking about in that way. Now, a little bit about the historical setting. Notice the superscription on this psalm. We had no way of knowing always whether these things are accurate or not, but do you notice what it says? A prayer of Moses, the man of God. And most of the scholars will say, well, there's no reason that we can see to question this. This would make this an old psalm, and it would mean that this has been a part of the thinking of the people of God throughout the centuries. And reading this psalm, as we will, the most likely historical setting for it then would be like 38 years or so into the journey from Egypt to the Promised Land, when they're just about to the end of it, and what's happened to a whole generation of people. And they've fallen in the wilderness, all the ones 20 years old and upward, and why has that happened? Was God not able to care for them or to provide for them? Or, I mean, did enemies beat them down? Did they starve to death? I mean, what happened to them?
Unbelief.
All right. Remember, it was God's judgment on them. He let their own words come true to them because of their unbelief. Remember when they sent the spies up to look at the land? And they came back and said, it's indeed a land flowing with milk and honey. And they talked about how bountiful it was up there. And then they said, let's go back to Egypt. Remember, it made all the sense in the world. It's just what God said it was. Let's go back to Egypt. Why?
Fear.
Fear. All right, there were giants up there, you know, and that kind of thing. So Moses has seen a whole generation of his people fall in the wilderness. Now, what about Moses? What's about to happen with him? Is he going to cross a river, and is he going to get to inherit the land?
No.
Why? All right, his disobedience. He was going to get to go up on the mountain and look over and see, but Moses is also going to fall, and he knows that. So the historical situation, I think Numbers 14 would show this, and maybe two passages from Deuteronomy would be appropriate. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 14 through 17 maybe would be an appropriate reading for us here. John, would you mind to read for us?
And the time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the brook Zered was 38 years.
John, I have John to read this because I know he likes the names of these places real well. A traveler like John. Go ahead, John.
38 years until the entire generation, that is, the men of war, had perished from the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. For indeed, the hand of the Lord was against them, to destroy them from the camp until they had perished. So, as soon as all the men of war had perished and were dead from among the people, the Lord said to me, today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar. And when you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot for possession.
All right, now, we'll stop there for a second. But you notice they're 38 years into this, and the whole generation have fallen, and they're at the last leg of their journey, and there are some things that they're not to do and so forth here in this reading. Now, skip over to the end of Deuteronomy now, the chapter 33. Now, you notice first the wilderness where they've been is not their home, and many of the whole that generation they're living, they've lived and they're dying, and things are as they have been and so forth, and it doesn't seem like anything's really happening. Now, over in Deuteronomy 33, I'd like for us to read 26 and 27. Michelle, do you mind to read that?
There is no one like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to help you, and in his excellency on the clouds. The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He will thrust out the enemy from before you, and will say, destroy.
All right, he goes ahead and talk about how he'll bless his people with the victory he gives them. But I want you to notice verse 27. The eternal God is your refuge, some versions say, your dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. So I'd like you to bear in mind now the contrast between these two statements at the beginning and the ending of Deuteronomy. 38 years of falling in the wilderness, then the eternal God is your dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And I think that Psalm 90 is written like if these are the two poles of the earth, Psalm 90, or of life on earth, then Psalm 90 is written against that background. And just to make it simple for us, please notice that we could think of this psalm as first the eternity of God, or the permanence of God, or of the living God. And this would be what verses 1 through 6 in this passage. Let's think about this. And this is a prayer, and think of it against the background of that we've just read. Lisa, how about your reading for us, if you would? I want to interrupt you a couple times, but notice these are in pairs, three pairs of two verses each. And think about what it says. Go ahead, Lisa.
Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations.
All right, let me interrupt. Now, do you see the connection there with the Deuteronomy 33, verse 27? Moses, in his prayer, is admitting what he taught Israel in Deuteronomy 33 and verse 7. God has always been our dwelling place. our refuge, if you will, and the only permanence that we have in all generations. All right, now go ahead, listen.
Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God.
All right, now we noticed in this passage here the before time and after time aspect of this. When we study God or the nature of God, we talk about the attributes of God, that is, the qualities that make him God. And usually these are thought of as the ones that are transitive, that is, they can be passed along to us and so forth. Things like his faithfulness, his love, his righteousness. These are things about him that we are to imitate and to make a part of ourselves, morally speaking. On the other hand, are the intransitive qualities of God. His power, his eternity, that is, there's no passing of time with him. He doesn't change. He doesn't grow. He doesn't age. He's not different than he was. He is God. And so that's what this passage admits here. In contrast to our fleeting nature, God was God before the mountains or before the earth or before the world were ever brought forth, and from everlasting to everlasting you are God. Now I would suggest that this is what the New Testament means when it refers to God as the living God. He has life in himself, and that's important. Now, go ahead, Alyssa, verses 3 and 4 now.
You return man to dust, say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night.
All right, now, in what sense does God return man to dust? What happened in Scripture which causes that to be a reality?
Man was made from the dust of the earth, and he will return.
All right, and what made him return to the dust?
Death.
All right, and what brought death?
Sin.
All right, so when sin enters the world, remember God says to the man and the woman in the beginning, that if you do this, you take the fruit of this tree, then you will die. And the tempter comes along and says, you will not die. You will not surely die. And then it's what happens is that separated from God, the journey back to the dust begins. And it involves aging, it involves murder, it involves accident, it involves the entire process that's involved in that. And so in a way, what happens in verse 3 has played itself out on a grand scale in the wilderness for a whole generation of Israelites. And it all is an expression of the judgment of God, where he allows people to experience the consequences of their own doing. Now, verse 4, look at the things here that emphasize the eternity of God. The 1,000 years, this would be conceived of as the grandest amount of time that you and I could imagine. You know, 1,000 years is not as opposed to 1,001 years. It is a figure for all the time there is. And it says here that 1,000 years in God's sight are as what? All right, it's just as yesterday when it's past. I've noticed with my grandchildren that one of the things about their way of speaking is that Kyra, for example, will say, last week I did this or that, and it might have been last night, or it might have been 2 months ago, but it's, she says, last week. So that's something of what we're saying here. It's a time is nothing to an eternal God, or as a watch in the night. How long is a watch in the night?
Yeah.
3 hours. So it's just that when it's passed. Now listen to verses 5 and 6.
He sweeps them away as with the flood, they are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, in the evening it fades and withers.
All right, observe the three illustrations now, all indicating that the fleeting nature of time or of life does not affect God. The first is with a flood. What sort of flood were they acquainted with in that arid land where the wilderness that they had passed through?
Flash flood, or just hit in the middle of it.
All right, it was not a flat land flood. It was a flash flood which had washed down these gullies all at once, and then it would be gone. It would go down as quickly as it rose. Now, that's one illustration. Second illustration is like a dream. What can you tell me about a dream? How many of you had a dream last night? How long was it? And how many details can you give? You know, not too many? All right. So you see the aptness of that illustration. And then, like the grass, any kind of plant that grew up, and at best it lasts 2 or 3 months while you watered it, and then it just sort of will turn brown again, and it'll be gone before long. That's the nature of things. So God is praised as our everlasting dwelling place. His superiority, or his unchangeableness over time, is honored, and then he is compared to the fleeting things that go on in this life. What do you think is the most important thing for us to remember about the eternal nature of God? All right, Eddie?
It's hard for my mind to fathom that there is no beginning and no end.
I'm not sure we're capable, are we, of really grasping that which we have not experienced. We can't imagine a dimension where time does not impact us, because all of us check up on time. That's how we live. That's one thing. So God is higher than our thoughts or our ways. Ruth?
Always the same.
Always the same. All right. The unchangeableness of God is one of the things that the Hebrew writer uses in Hebrews 13 and verse 7 to try to emphasize the fact that we ought to be faithful, because God, it's talking about Christ especially there, but it doesn't change. Hebrews 13, verse 8, maybe it is. And that's one important thing. Anybody, by the way, that, when you study the attributes of God, that will be called the immutability of God. You'll run across that phrase. Anything else? This is a crucial aspect to the idea of God keeping his covenants. And the idea is, if I live in my lifetime, and for example, when I first heard of God, I heard of his promises and so forth that were going to be fulfilled when the Lord comes again, and I've lived now a lifetime, and I'm still thinking about that or hearing about that. What leads me to believe that it still could be true? My faith, but my faith in God's eternity. And that, is that a challenge? Yes, it is. You can't see it. But if you think about your own longing for something that lasts, then you can conceive of the God who must be behind that. All right, that's one thing. And then in this prayer, what we next have is the temporary nature of man. And this is described in verses 7 through 11 in our text. So let's read this part of the prayer. And remember, the part of this is going to be phrased in view of the fact that Israel has experienced God's judgment by God's having allowed them to pronounce their own fate, if I can say it that way. And you read Numbers 14, you see what we're getting at. Now, notice the contrast in this part of the chapter as well, verses 7 through 11. Becky, start verse 7, please.
For we have been consumed by thy anger, and by thy wrath we have been dismayed.
All right, let me interrupt a little bit. Now, remember that this is not a fit of anger on God's part. How many times had Israel complained and grumbled and murmured and wanted to go back to Egypt before God pronounced what he did in Numbers 14? It'd say these 10 times, I think God says, in one of those places. In other words, they've done it over and over again. And notice that it hadn't happened. God didn't just snap his fingers and wipe them out. He just let them experience the effects of the journey, and it took its toll on them over this period of time. And so the people, Moses is confessing their subjection to God's judgment. Go ahead, Becky, verse 8.
Thou hast placed our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy presence. For all our days have declined in thy fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of thine anger and thy fury according to the fear that is due thee?
All right, you notice that verse 7 and verse 11 both speak of God's anger and of his wrath, his judgment against his people. And in between are the effects of man's living in a world where his own iniquities and sins are at work in him. That's from verse 8. Now, verses 9 and 10 have the contrast that I want you to see. Mm-hmm. All our days do what? All right, that's how many. But in verse 9, they all pass. All right, isn't it true? I remember the lady at Green Forest, Arkansas, who told me that her favorite phrase from Scripture is, "It came to pass." And that's the way our days are. And then we bring our years to an end like a sigh. What's a sigh? Anybody in here volunteer to demonstrate what a sigh is? All right. Okay. All right. So you if you think of in the grand scheme of things, that's the not only the length of our days, but that's how far away from the end of them we are. Remember David's in one of David's prayers. There's a but a breath between me and the end of my then the classic statement in verse 10, the years of our lives are 70. Think of that, and even by reason of strength, 80. Now in our culture, with all the money we spend on medical care and all the wisdom of science and all that, our life expectancy may exceed that, but not, we don't escape the point that's being made here, do we? That, that still we are temporary. And he says their span is, or their pride is, how did that read, Becky? Labor and sorrow. And they are, when are they gone?
Soon
gone, and then we fly away. One of the things to observe about biblical thought, it does say, then we're done, or we're gone. It says, we fly away. I'm glad for that statement in this passage. And so this reality in the Bible is always present, but it always looks forward to the work of the resurrection of Christ. And that's that because of God's covenant with to bless man through Abraham, and there is the promise, and because of our circumstance, we recognize the need and try to confess it. And now the third part of our passage, and we'll do it fairly quickly, but it is, how can I say it? It is, just this way, wisdom regarding life. There's three parts of this little statement here in verses 12 through, is it 17? Is that the last word?
Yes.
All right. And you'll notice the three requests that are made. And what I'm asking us is, don't these really make sense for all of us? These three values that are asked for in this prayer. First one is in verses 12 and 13. Tim, read that for us.
So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Lord, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants.
All right, be sorry, have pity, have compassion on us. So what about that verse? What does he mean in verse 12?
Remember your days, be careful how you use them.
All right, so it's not talking about teach us to know how long we will live, or teach us to think I have been allotted by fate so many days and I'm marking them off a calendar and I have so many left. Not that, but in terms of the New Testament, Ephesians 5, to redeem the time, teach us to make good use of our lives. Now, what is God trying to teach us in his word?
You have but one life to live.
All right, to make good. He's teaching us how to live well. This lady that I mentioned a while ago said, but I did have the chance to know and love each and every friend, and as well as all my family members. How much more blessed can a person be? So in the end, remember, do your best, follow your arrow, she says, and make something amazing out of your life. Isn't that pretty much the same thing and a different... isn't it a human need for us to feel like we are investing our lives in something that's worth our lives? And so, how do we know what's worth our lives? Are we at the mercy of whatever is the popular thought at the time in popular culture? No, we need the eternal God to explain to us how temporary people ought to be investing their lives. That's what the teaching of Scripture is about. This is how to live. This is how to invest your life in something that's worth your life, and not the bigger barns of the fellow in Luke chapter 12. The second part of the prayer, verses 14 and 15. Yes, read it. Yvonne, would you mind to read that, those two verses?
Oh, satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us and the years we have seen evil.
All right. Think of what Moses is saying in that last part. The view of what he's seen his people go through. Make us glad. Make all of those years count for something. Give us the other side of that experience now. And verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness. Loving kindness is the word for covenant loyalty, covenant love. It's steadfast love or mercy, those ideas. What had God given Israel in the wilderness every morning, except on the Sabbath? I've given you a big hint there, you know that. What?
Manna.
And Moses may be thinking across the river here, God satisfies every morning with your loving kindness. And that's a prayer for God's loving kindness. It's also a prayer for his people to be satisfied or be glad in God's loving kindness. And think about that for a minute. It is easy for us to ask God for things, and then God give us this day our daily bread, and God gives it to us, and then we're not satisfied with it. Have you noticed that? And so I think a couple weeks ago we studied about contentment when we were reading 1 Timothy 6, and that would be a part of this, I believe, wouldn't it? I think it satisfies with your loving kindness. And then, I know the bell must have rung. Verses 16 and 17, what does it say? I'm sorry for keeping you too long here. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glory out of your children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish our work, the work of our hands. I think he's saying, be gracious enough to us to help, to allow us to do some things with our lives that are going to matter beyond this. Establish the work of our hands. We don't want to just get to our lives to be about nothing more than a grave marker. And so there has to be the investment in things that are permanent in that way. I sure appreciate y'all thinking along with us. And sorry I kept you so long. Your kids and grandkids will be in the auditorium waiting for you.